ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is George Jang, the VP of Product at Cognique, a personalized content recommendation engine designed for media companies. Cognique has been an innovator in the recommendation space and works with brands like Nickelodeon, MTV, and France TV. George is responsible for delivering scalable enterprise-grade technology solutions. Before joining Cognique, George oversaw digital production, ad operations, and optimization for Time Out Magazine's North American properties, and has worn a variety of different hats ranging from developer, graphic designer, to product owner. He's a self-described technology enthusiast with a love of problem solving. George, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's first talk specifically about Cognique. How does it actually implement the technology? I know that MTV and Nickelodeon are two major clients. Where does your recommender system work from? Does it work from those networks' apps? Is it on their websites? Where does it live?
Sure. So our platform is quite unique in the sense that for our specific application, I'll just take one of our applications, Mining Junior, it works across all their apps, their website, and even their set-top box. So what we've done is created a personalized linear stream for the parents. So the parents can basically sit there and say, hey, I want themes of sharing and counting, and my child really loves Paw Patrol and Dora the Explorer, and they kind of set these preferences up, and then we create a linear stream that's personalized to that kind of parent's expectations, but also to what the child likes. And then they really get a linear stream of Dora the Explorer with Paw Patrol, with all the kind of theme, educational themes that the parent wants. And you get, and the recommendation will kind of adapt to the child's learnings so that if the child kind of skips a lot of these types of episodes, we'll know that the child doesn't like it. So we'll kind of offer them different flavors, maybe different series or different kind of other episodes that might be more relevant to their interests.
Wow, I wish that had been around when my kids were little, let me tell you. So, but just so I understand, what if you're a parent and you are a lazy parent and you don't want to actually set it up, but you want your child, it then looks at the history of the child's watching. So the starting point is at the discretion or involvement of the parent, and then from there it learns and grows.
Correct. So this is kind of a problem that we see in the recommendation space. It's called a cold start, right? Where if I don't know anything about you, what do I present to you? So from the Mining Junior example, we'll default to what the parent wants. So that initial time, there is a setup, kind of very similar to when you're setting up your Netflix account for the very first time, right? They'll ask you a series of questions of what the things that you like. There are other ways to approaching the cold start. So in MTV, for example, we've created a personalized music player. So think Pandora, but for music videos, right? And so you do have this kind of ability to say, okay, well, I don't want anything, inspire me, right? But let's say I don't know anything about that user. What we can default to is to the editorial or programming team's expertise, right? So we give them the ability to say, hey, these are the top 10 music videos that we really kind of want to, you know, promote, or, you know, these are the things that we really think are like timely or trending right now. And these are all factors that can kind of go into that personalization when you don't know anything about that user.
Ah, okay. On your site, it says you use social media trends to assess a topic's popularity. How do you do this? And then how does that factor into the technology?
So each implementation is, you know, kind of unique to how we would do it. But in the MTV example, we use YouTube as kind of that proxy, right? So think of if you have a bunch of music videos that are all on YouTube, right? We can pull down the views and the likes and the dislikes and the comments around it to basically understand kind of where the general kind of sentiment around each particular video would be, right? Mm-hmm. That's how, at least in that particular use case that we've used it. If you were a publisher and you wanted to kind of be really on top of trending news, you could kind of use the hashtags or the retweets as a proxy for popularity.
I see. That's interesting. So it's also interesting that, so YouTube in your view is a social is a social site. I mean, I think that's interesting because there's been, I've been on other panels and we've had some lively debate around, is YouTube a social network or not?
In a purest sense, I would say no, it is not. In the sense of being able to use it as a proxy for understanding what people think about it, I think so, right? Social networks like Facebook, for example, to be able to see what the entire Facebook community is talking about, it's actually quite difficult because of the kind of restrictions that they have with
right.
protecting everybody. So even though they have a wealth of data, unless you're Facebook, you can't access it.
Yeah. Darn. So annoying. Yes. Oh, funny. Okay, there, you know, now I want to shift gears. I want to talk a little bit about Vincent and chatbots. You've written a Medium post about Vincent, and I'm just going to quote a little piece for our listeners. Publishers are in a tough spot with declining print revenue, the use of ad blockers, and dynamically changing landscape. Now more than ever, publishers need every edge to keep their users engaged. Personalization is an extremely effective tool in delivering the ideal content to the right user. So, Vincent, can you tell the listeners what Vincent is?
Sure. So, at the time, we were playing with around with the idea of how can we demonstrate personalization in a quick and easy to kind of digestible way. And we decided, well, why don't we create a chatbot? You know, part of it was chatbots were kind of very timely. Everyone was talking about chatbots. And we're like, hey, we'll build a chatbot. Why not, right? So that's why we built the chatbot. How we decided to kind of create the chatbot or the flow within the chatbot, we were saying, well, what's the minimum amount of interactions that we can have with a user to kind of start creating a personalized, you know, experience off of that? So what we did was we pulled in news from the Associated Press. And the Associated Press, for those kind of data geeks out there, they're really great with their tagging, better than most other organizations with how data is structured. So they're very clean with how they're saying, okay, this is about government, and they're, you know, the topics are very clean about the economy and, you know, celebrity news and lifestyle. But then they're also able to take one level of granularity to give you the entity. So it's like, oh, it's talking about New York City. It's talking about Donald Trump. It's talking about the Kardashians, right? Like they're able to kind of get that level of granularity. So we were saying, could we create a chatbot around the Associated Press? So we took the RSS feed from the Associated Press, took the tagging that they had associated to their content already, loaded it into our platform, and then basically plugged our platform into a chatbot. And then the experience that we gave users was, if you came on board, you would say, okay, well, what's interesting to me? I want government. And then we would randomize a bit of the kind of hot trending topics in the last, I think, 7 days. So if you wanted to know about, you know, Donald Trump or the Kardashians, for example, or Justin Bieber, right? We would then basically take those two data points and then create a personalized set of, I think, 10 articles that were hyper-relevant, timely for that user's, based on that user's preference.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So a lot of analysts seem to frame chatbots as a way for customers or consumers to interact with a company if they have questions, or for companies to directly push, sell, advertise to users. So it seems like your perspective is really just around the sort of the personalization. Was it really, do you see chatbots as another piece in the personalization mission? Or was this just kind of an example because it was hot in the market? You decided we're going to do an example here, but this isn't really where we're pushing. I mean, where do you see chatbots functioning?
Yeah. So chatbots, and, you know, I kind of, for me personally, I lump chatbots in with voice activated features. So think Alexa, think like
right.
Echo, only because it's a medium that users are not used to, or it's new to our users, right? So people are just getting used to voice activation in terms of saying, you know, Alexa, show me something. And chatbots, you know, when you kind of present somebody with a chatbot, you know, their users are quite used to chatting, but they're not used to chatting with a computer.
Right.
So your initial first reactions with a chatbot are going to be very stale, right? They're like, oh, I realize I have to kind of go this way or that way. You see a lot of chatbots kind of getting around that problem by just giving you hard options, right? Like yes or no, you can't do kind of free text. I think the first hurdle that chatbots and even voice activated kind of devices need to kind of get over is the fact that it has to feel natural. It has to really understand user intent around natural language processing. Once you kind of get past that hurdle and you're able to say, okay, I understand what the user wants, then personalization can kind of come in and fill the gap and say, okay, this user really wants music around the mood of a party, so let's give them this song, versus not being able to even understand what that user wants because you don't give them that understanding or that, you know, kind of deeper kind of granularity.
It's interesting. Do you think that the adoption, I mean, for me, I have young-ish children, and they love the voice stuff, and it just isn't really, I don't really like it personally. But I think the chatbots I could do. That feels much more comfortable. Do you think that they will sort of be there for a period of transition? Do you think that they're here to stay? There was a software executive which was quoted as saying, we're in the midst of a once in a decade paradigm shift. Messaging is the new platform and bots are the new apps. Do you believe that? That seems a bit, I don't know if I agree. What do you think?
From my personal perspective, I would say there's a couple of things. I wasn't a big fan of voice activated stuff either. But one of the things, and so I have a very young child as well, and he still sits in a stroller. So if you ever try to text message while pushing a stroller, it's extremely hard.
yeah, this is true. It's dangerous too.
Absolutely, right? You're kind of veering left and right. People in New York are, you know, not really that patient. So like they're kind of giving you ugly stares. For me, voice activated anything really took off when I realized I can text message through voice.
When
I realized I could spit out a message really quickly just because like, hey, you know, I'm running late or whatever it is, but do it via voice instead of typing. That was kind of that kind of first step for me. And I became a kind of true believer of that. So I would say, if you're not a believer yet, try text message.
It might
do it for you. Having a stroller really kind of did it for me.
I think that's so funny.
But in terms of kind of chatbots being the new apps, yes and no. I think it's going to be a gateway. I think chatbots are a great way to kind of get the conversation started or kind of introduce new things. Or I guess the problem is right now, a lot of chatbot developers think of chatbots as apps. And when they think of apps, they feel like it always has to be on, right?
Right.
Versus there's a company called Greatest. You know, they cover a lot of kind of like healthy topics and like kind of lifestyle like topics, but they write it in the kind of view of, if you're not an expert in this, this is kind of like the intro way into kind of healthy living, right? Mm-hmm. So they took a very different perspective about it, and they have a chatbot that's on the website, and their chatbot's very simple in the sense that it just recommends one article a day and it gives it to you in the morning, and that's it, right? So it's not always on, right? And it basically just says, hey, here's something that you might be interested in today, right? And I think that is extremely personal and relevant to the user, because they're like, look, I'm not an expert in CrossFit or whatever it is, the trend these days, but like, you know what? It's interesting because, you know, it gives me that one article. I can read it later or I can read it now, but it's, you know, it's just kind of, here's something that you might be interested in. And I think chatbots are extremely good at giving you hyper relevant to the time, to that point at the moment. And that's it. And if you kind of master that flow or that user experience, I think you've hit something. But will it be a full-blown, fully immersive, that's the only thing you're interacting with? I don't think so.
Right, right. Well, now I want to move on to the Above the Fold project. So in January, you created this website, Above the Fold, that aggregates the top news from 20 news outlets, and users can filter the news by political bias. Super awesome. How did you get the idea?
Oh, I don't know how political your show wants to be.
That's okay. It's all good.
So for me, it really kind of came out of the presidential election. I was getting, you know, like most users, I was getting a lot of my news from Facebook. And right. me living in New York, you know, kind of being, I guess, on the cusp of what is considered a millennial, I was kind of reading all this stuff. And I was so sure Trump wasn't going to win. I was telling people, I'd be having conversations with my parents that were living in Taiwan, and they were like, is Trump going to win? I'm like, no, he's never going to win, right? Like, I was so confident. And the election was such an eye-opening experience to me, because I pride myself on being somebody that is extremely well-read and kind of on top of what is happening in current events. And I felt like I was taken by complete surprise. And I realized it was kind of like, Well, there was kind of two things that kind of happened. One, I was extremely pissed, right?
But
the other side of it was like, I felt really disappointed in my inability to kind of, you know, see the larger picture. I had fallen into this kind of, this bubble. And I was kind of like, well, you know, what can I do about this? And you know, the more we started kind of thinking about it, you know, being that I'm in the personalization kind of, you know, recommendation space, I was like, well, I guess partly to fault for this because I am the guy that behind the algorithm that's saying
feeding people what they it feeds the echo chamber, right?
Exactly, so. Right? Absolutely. So, you know, we were kind of, you know, guilty of kind of, you know, kind of furthering this. And I started thinking, it's like, well, is there a way that I as a, you know, kind of news junkie can stay on top of it? And is there a better way to do this? So I started kind of looking at, you know, there was a couple, oh, here's from the right, here's the news from, and I was, okay, I want to hit 20 news sites every day, right?
Right, of course.
And that's kind of how Above the Fold was born. I started kind of thinking, okay, well, there's 20 news sites. It's easy to pull in the kind of what's on their front page because that's timely. That is kind of what their editorial team thinks is the thing that everyone should read. Mm-hmm. And so I took basically 20 editorial front pages, kind of cobbled it together, and basically the site runs by itself. I have a couple of very avid readers that really love the app and I use it, and it keeps me on abreast of what's going on.
So one question, because monetization for platforms is such an issue, and I, one of my early interviews was with the CEO of the Boston Globe. How do you deal with access? I mean, do people eventually hit it? Like if they're on your, I think you get like 10 articles usually before then, each month or something before you're flagged to please subscribe. And gee, shouldn't we all be subscribing to hard journalism because it's such a valuable thing. But how does that affect the reader of your service?
So I've gotten a couple complaints from people saying like the Financial Times. There's a couple people with paywalls out there. And, you know, I see it as the, you know, so I have a digital publishing background. I used to work at Time Out. So I feel the pain of publishers that need to, you know, make money through advertising or through a subscription base. And so from my perspective, whenever I speak to my readers that, you know, say, well, is there a way for me to get around this paywall?
And no.
No. That means you really like the content, pay for it. Right. Because, you know, at the end of the day, it costs money, right? And to put out this great content you love to consume, stop trying to like hack around it, pay for it.
Right.
And so that's my message to the users that try to get around paywalls. And like, yeah, sure, there's a couple of tricks that you could do, but I'm not going to help facilitate that.
And of course, my immediate thought was, oh, what are those tricks? I won't ask. One thing, there's a lot of talk in tech communities and in the business world that CTOs and other high-ranking tech developers stop coding at some point because they don't need to do so on a daily basis. So it looks like, you know, this Above the Fold project, you still enjoyed jumping in and coding. Is that, did you do it or did you direct other people?
No, this was a side project that I did after my kid goes to sleep. And I think I started thinking about it for about a month. And then one day I was just like, come on, let's just do it. And I think within like a week or two, like we had the first kind of prototype out. I personally really enjoy kind of getting my hands dirty in the code. Uh-huh. Like as a, you know, as the VP of product for a 12-person company, you know, we're small enough where I have that flexibility to kind of jump in and, you know, help out in certain areas that we might not have the resources or bandwidth for. For me, I think it's a way to stay relevant. It's a way to kind of earn your stripes when you're speaking to developers that might not expect that you understand their pain.
Right, of course.
For me, I feel like it really does help me understand where the engineers are coming from, where the developers are coming from. I feel like I communicate better with them. I feel like, you know, I relate to them better. So it's something I hope I will stay kind of close to. One day we're like a 200-person company and like there's no need for me to touch the code anymore. I feel like I will still have interest.
Seems like you're going to still do side projects, it seems to me. Like just gauging on that. Just out of curiosity, what programming languages did you use for the Above the Fold?
So the Above the Fold is, the front end is on React, the back end is on PHP, and the database is Mongo.
Wow, cool. And on your website, it says that you're an advocate of the lean startup methodology. And for folks who aren't familiar about that, the sort of the gist of that idea is that you develop a minimum viable product to push into the world, get feedback quickly, and improve the product for the startup. So I want to hear more about your thoughts around that. I mean, how closely do you keep to that?
I think especially as in a startup, you can't afford to waste a lot of time. There's kind of two things, right? So we're a startup that plays in the media, like big media space. So for the business standpoint, the media space has really long sales cycles, right? So when you're working on a deal with Viacom, you can easily spend a year negotiating the terms or working out the how it's going to look. So if you think of it in terms of a startup, a year can make or break a startup, right?
Like, sure.
So you really need to kind of make sure that what you put out there in the market and what you present are really things that the market really wants. That kind of being said, because you don't, because we're a B2B company, you don't have like a million customers that you could kind of A/B test all day with.
Right.
So for us, we spend a lot of time talking to the other product managers of the companies that are currently working with us to get the kind of understanding of what do they want and where they're going. You know, we're not shy with kind of showing them a wireframe and be like, hey, this is how we're thinking that we're doing this. What do you think? Right.
They're open to that. They don't feel like, dude, that's what we're hiring you for.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that's the advantage of being in a startup. Is they kind of expect it. And like a lot of the product managers that we speak with, they almost they're so receptive to it. It's almost like it's something fun for them to give feedback on something that like, you know, they have, you know, a potential hand in kind of creating. Like, well, I would say very rarely do I get someone say no, right? Like we were speaking to a potential integrator, a potential partner of ours, and they were saying, hey, for us to basically show that we're relevant to all these other media companies out there, we're basically bringing on all these startups that we say we have a partnership with just to show that we're innovative and we're staying relevant in this space. Like to them, a lot of these kind of larger companies, keeping in touch with startups and helping startups kind of fine tune their product is how they stay innovative.
Right.
So far it's been pretty good. And that's how we test our MVPs and kind of make sure that we're kind of on the right track when we're building kind of our larger product.
Right, right. So do you see any other important trends? I mean, you talked about voice as a trend that's coming or is already really here. What would you say are other industry trends that people need to be aware of and open their eyes toward?
People should open their eyes toward. I would say that I think advertising, from a digital publishing standpoint, I think advertising is going to take a pretty big change in the next couple of years. So there's
do you think that's because of the Internet of Things and closing the buying loop, or what's driving that change, or is it just the change that's already happening?
There's a couple of things kind of pointing to that trend, right? So ad blockers are on the rise. They're huge in the European Union. They're growing in the U.S.
Well, did you know that? Here's a little factoid for you. One of our surveys, 2/3 of millennials use ad blockers, and it's only growing. So yeah, it's a big thing.
Yeah. And that's like when you think of companies like Vice and Refinery29 that are like, hey, we cater to millennials and 2/3 of their users have ad blockers, right? You kind of do the math. They're like, it's a problem, right?
Yeah.
I would say that advertising in general, like the very invasive ads, the kind of pre-roll that plays with sound and like those really abusive user, those experiences that aren't really beneficial to the user, I think they're all going to go away.
I hope, right? So I guess my question is, so we see this as a huge user experience no-no.
Right.
And everybody, you know, you go to the Variety Entertainment and Tech Conference and everybody's like, oh, you know, but people, relevant ads and targeted ads and one-to-one, and it's going to be interesting. Is that really going to happen? I mean, we were on a panel together and we talked about the sort of the targeting.
Yeah, I'm buying it as in the sense that the tech is definitely there. I mean, being in personalization in this space, we're leveraging a lot of the advertising industry when we're applying it to how we personalize content, right? But
You think the creative is just not there? I mean, fine, we're personalizing, but it's still that annoying advertisement. And so it's got to be a better content.
No, I want to say that. I would say that I think one of the big shifts that's going to really happen is Chrome is adding this ad blocker in, right? And I think that's gonna make everyone kind of rethink their strategy, right? Especially with the rise of programmatic as an advertiser and as an agency. And I know I'm grossly kind of generalizing this, but like it's too easy for an agency to just spray and pray ads on programmatic, right? Like it's so cheap. Why don't you, right? I mean, they're kind of like, it's okay. We're just going to A/B test and figure out what works. And then we'll just kind of like, you know, double down on the one that does work, right? Like,
right.
I don't think that's the right strategy. And I don't think it's a sustainable strategy moving forward. And so I think having really kind of engaging content through sponsored content, I really think that's kind of the future of it, where like, look, I'm going to read this great article about how Nike's doing like this great stuff with like, you know, the soles of their shoes or recycling. And like, yeah, I'm going to, you know, buy the brand of Nike because I believe in it.
I think that there are certainly brands that were that applies, but then you get to sort of your laundry detergent pods. It's increasingly challenging. Anyway, we've actually run really, really fast.
Wow, already? Okay.
I know, right? Can you believe it? Anything else that I didn't ask you, which you think, my gosh, we really need to know?
I mean, like, this interview was very painless, so I'm okay with it.
There's no pain.
I mean, like, you know, when someone says, you know, they want to interview you, you're just like, okay.
Well, you have lots of interesting stuff. I mean, I guess, I do have one last question. How do you continue to improve on personalization? I mean, obviously, yeah. I mean, once you acquire a customer, is that it? Or do you keep, how do you?
Yeah, so I think this is kind of one of the things that we take a different approach toward personalization than a couple of our other competitors. We've built personalization, you know, kind of on two things that we think are extremely important. One, it has to be easy to implement from a kind of engineer developer standpoint. But two, that the way that the recommendation is delivered has to be transparent so that the programming team or the product team can kind of go in there and tweak how the algorithm is performing without kind of going to the code, right? So we kind of, when we present our product to our clients, we basically tell them personalization is an iterative process. We don't claim to have the master algorithm that kind of fits everybody and will work perfectly kind of when we start it. We basically tell them we have a set of algorithms and we can kind of influence the weights of one over the other, but it's really up to you to figure out for your audience and for your content, what are the dimensions and what are the attributes that really resonate for your users? And that will basically determine what that next step is, right? So we kind of tell them, you got to think of it, you know, you have to embrace personalization just like A/B testing and optimization, where it's an iterative process and you learn from it and you improve from it. And It's not set it or forget it.
I like that. We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who helped bring the program to life. First, my friend, Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open. And of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media, and a big thank you to our guest, George Jang. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.